Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think all parents are always dealing with kids not wanting to eat things, and a great way to get over their aversions is to get them to understand food and to get into the kitchen and prepare all sorts of things.
Sarah Elton has written a book about kids and food. She tells us what happened when she sat back and let her daughter prepare sushi. More young people in the kitchen today with Stacy Radford Vincent and her son Forrest. Who doesn't love a warm cup of hot chocolate? Chef Daniel Orr makes us a Caribbean-inspired drink. Equally spicy and flavorful are his kale chips. Harvest Public Media takes a closer look at the role the Corn Belt is playing in the carbon cycle. And early spring is on the horizon. We're already starting to think about tapping maple trees with Mike Bell. Stories that caught our eye this week with Luann Johnson.
President Barack Obama has proposed consolidating food safety efforts into one body as a way of decreasing overhead. Currently, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration share food safety oversight duties. The USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service oversees meat, poultry, and eggs, while the FDA oversees other food. Together, 12 agencies enforce 30 different laws. As proposed in the fiscal year 2016 budget, all food safety oversight would be combined into a single agency under the umbrella of the Department of Health and Human Services. Several food industry advocates are preparing to fight the proposed rules, fearing increased oversight. A different proposal, put forth by consumer groups and two lawmakers, suggests forming a new food safety agency entirely outside the HHS. The Food Safety Modernization Act will go into effect at the end of fiscal year 2016. 7 of 10 toddler meals contained too much salt, and most pastries and snacks designed for the age group contained added sugars. That's according to a study by researchers at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, published in the journal Pediatrics. 1 in 3 toddler foods also contained added sugar. The study looked at 1,074 infant and toddler food products from 2012, with 1/4 of children ages 2 to 5 overweight or obese. High salt and sugar levels in foods are alarming health professionals. Children ages 1 to 3 should have no more than 1,500 milligrams of sodium a day. Industry advocates are concerned the study is unnecessarily alerting consumers, arguing it does not take into account changes in packaged food since then, including reducing sodium. Researchers encourage parents to read labels on children's foods to ensure excess salt and sugar aren't sneaking into their children's diets. And this week, NPR followed up on a story about nitrates in Iowa's water supply. During the initial broadcast, journalist Dan Charles mentioned fertilizer as a source of nitrogen on the farm crops. He stated nitrogen in the fertilizer turns to nitrate, which runs off and into streams. Sarah Carlson of Practical Farmers of Iowa contacted Charles and explained nitrate is usually used by plants in the soil. But when the soil is barren, like soybean and cornfields are in the winter, the nitrate continues to be produced with nowhere to go. The solution? Cover crops. A cover crop grows during the winter when everything else freezes. In Indiana, that means rye or wheat or certain late summer or early fall legumes like hairy vetch, big flower vetch, Austrian winter peas, and crimson clover. Not only do cover crops keep nitrate from overflowing into streams and then wreaking havoc on habitats and wildlife, they protect against water and wind erosion, improve the soil, and boost crop yield. Cover crops also attract honeybees and beneficial insects. We've collected a series of links about cover crops if you want to learn more. Find the article at eartheats.org.
If you've got thoughts to share on cover crops or food labels or food safety, our Twitter page is the place to share them. Find us at Earth Eats. And you find Luann Johnson at the top of every show. Thanks for the news.
Have a good one.
Scientists have noticed a change in the atmosphere. Plants are taking in more carbon dioxide during the growing season and giving off more carbon in the fall and winter. What researchers hadn't considered until recently is what farming has to do with it. Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media has more.
If you want to see the carbon cycle at work, go to the middle of an empty cornfield. I'm walking over chopped up stalks and corn husks with Andy Suker, a micrometeorologist from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. This field looks about like any other this time of year, brown and bare, until we come to a weather tower covered with scientific instruments, buzzing sensors, spinning anemometers.
We have a carbon dioxide and water vapor sensor, and it's continuously measuring CO2 concentration, water vapor concentration.
This research station in eastern Nebraska measures the movement of carbon dioxide 10 times a second, 24/7, for the last 15 years. You might look at a windblown cornfield in the dead of winter and think nothing is happening, but Suker knows otherwise.
The ecosystem during the non-growing season period is, in a sense, it's exhaling carbon dioxide.
Over the winter, corn stalks and roots break down, sending CO2 into the air. Then in the summer, when a new crop is growing here,
then there's a net uptake of carbon dioxide. So that's like you're breathing in. So there's this constant breathing in, taking up carbon dioxide, and breathing out, releasing carbon dioxide.
That's the carbon cycle, and it's different than fossil fuel emissions. This is a give and take, CO2 constantly shifting between plants and the air. And about 20 years ago, scientists realized the peaks and valleys of the carbon cycle are reaching higher and lower levels. Joshua Gray studies the carbon cycle at Boston University.
The depth of that breath has gotten bigger. So the CO2 concentrations go down a little bit more in the summer than they used to, and they go up a little bit more in the winter than they used to.
50% more in the northern hemisphere. Most of the increase is due to a longer growing season brought on by a warming climate. But in a recent article in the journal Nature, Gray and his colleagues uncovered another human impact on the carbon cycle, farming. Gray says scientists overlooked farming before. It only covers 6% of the land in the area he studied, but he found it accounts for a quarter of the increase to the carbon cycle.
You know, it's surprising and not surprising all at the same time. It's a bit of a head slapper. It's surprising to get the result, and then you say, oh, well, of course. Well, we have three times as much corn as we did 50 years ago. Of course, this is going on.
Farming has made huge strides in northern China and the U.S. Corn Belt. Better equipment, better crop hybrids and weed control, more irrigation and fertilizer. The fact that farming feeds the carbon cycle does not mean it's making climate change worse. But when it comes to reversing climate change, Gray says growing wheat or corn does less to sequester carbon than growing, say, a forest or grassland.
We're not gaining more long-term carbon in the soil or anything like that by growing more corn like we might with growing more oak trees.
But what if carbon-hungry corn plants did store CO2 underground? The Department of Agriculture, along with conservation groups, have been trying to develop methods of carbon farming, ways to use agriculture to remove carbon pollution from the air. It's challenging. Scientists disagree on how to measure the impact of different farming techniques. Plus, Gray says crops weren't designed for storing carbon.
Crop breeding has tried to say, if you take a kilogram of carbon out of the air, I want as much of that kilogram to go into the thing that I want to eat as possible. Now, this is at odds with sequestering carbon in the soil, where you would want to put as much carbon as possible in the roots.
Still, there is great potential. Back at the weather station, Andy Suker explains that corn, the region's top crop, is a world-class carbon consumer.
And in fact, for a corn crop, when it's taking up peak amount of carbon dioxide, it will take up as much CO2 as an Amazon forest.
As research continues, scientists want to find a way to leverage that skill and take more carbon from the atmosphere and put it under the Corn Belt. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Looking at the blog on the Harvest website, the idea that we've perhaps hit peak farmers market. But Luke Runyon says that might not actually be a bad thing. Read that at harvestpublicmedia.org. The first question I always ask guests in the Earth Eats studios is what they've had for lunch. It helps set the levels on the microphone. Few people have been as excited about that question as Forrest.
Peppers, small peppers, and some seaweed, and some Doritos, and I also had some carrots. I ate carrots, and that's pretty much it.
That is 6-year-old Forrest Radford Vincent.
F-O-R-E-S-T.
And his mom,
Stacy Radford Vincent, program and outreach manager at Wonder Lab.
She's the coordinator of a program at the Wonder Lab called Kids in the Kitchen. Their first event was called Sugar Sleuths. It gave parents the tools to read ingredients labels and, more specifically, to recognize all the different names for sugary sweeteners that are included in a lot of processed foods. Stacy said it was also important to give the kids the opportunity to make food themselves.
So instead of just giving the healthy message to the parents and them trying to get the kids to follow through, we wanted to involve the kids as well, because the more the kids are involved with their healthy eating, the more likely that they are to do it. It's also about learning what's in your food, knowing what's in there, and getting kids used to the taste of real food. But we also wanted the kids to learn that there's a difference between a fruit snack and a strawberry, even though they both taste, you know, they both taste good and they're both sweet, but that whole food is better for them.
Forrest was a presenter that day. He demonstrated how to make avocado banana pudding. First, he started with knife safety.
Well, first, let me tell you how to hold it so you don't cut yourself. Keep your fingers away from the knife. Move them as you cut. Then I put it in a bag and everyone mashed it with their fists.
Start back. What are the ingredients?
Avocado and banana. That's the ingredients for it. One slice of each. And then you cut it up into pieces. But you don't like cut it up like mincing it. That's not it. You just cut it up in slices and then put it in the bag and mush it. And then you can eat it. It was really good.
Stacy and her husband got Forrest involved in cooking right away when he was 2 years old.
Basically, when he could stand on a stool, we would let him be in there while we were doing stuff and, you know, let him measure things with the spoon or stir something. And then we progressively have moved up to more advanced things. So he's actually, well, like you heard, he knows the difference between mincing and slicing. We can tell him to chop something or to slice it, and he knows how to do that.
Yeah.
And he's really good with measuring things out, and it's been a great way to teach him some math skills. Yeah. So we have been starting to become familiar with fractions, knowing what 1/2 looks like and 1/4 looks like.
Yeah. 1/8 is 8 slices out of 1.
That's right.
Yeah, pretty smart, ain't I?
Forrest likes vegetables now, but Stacy knows that sometimes he chooses a donut over, say, an apple. And that's okay. She just hopes that these food values will stay with him when he eventually leaves the house to go be on his own.
As I was growing up, we were real healthy eaters. And when I got to my teenage years, I was not the healthiest eater. But then when I went away to college, all of those things came back to me. And those skills that I could cook, I didn't have to order pizza every night, that I could cook my own meals. And, you know, now we do it out of fun.
They've made butter and cheese at home. With a little prodding, Forrest can recite a basic homemade cheese recipe.
Well, you pretty much need milk.
Some plain yogurt.
And yogurt, yeah.
And then what do we put in it to separate it?
Vinegar.
There you go.
And then we pretty much cook it. What? Cool. And it's done. You can eat it.
You know, sometimes you can't control what your kids are going to eat, you know, when they're at school, and, you know, they have to make their own choices. But when they're at home, then it's even that much more important to make sure that they're getting those nutrients at home.
And you can stay healthy. Yeah. Do not smoke. That's a pretty much another way that you can stay healthy. Try a water cigarette or something like that. That's healthy.
Stacy Radford Vincent and her son Forrest came into the Earth Eats studios. Sarah Elton also encourages her kids to be hands-on with food, so when her 9-year-old asked to make sushi for dinner one night, she took a deep breath.
I tried to remind myself, you know, don't worry that her ratios are a little bit off. It made a big mess. There was rice on the table. We figured out how to clean it up and save the rice so it didn't end up in the garbage. And it was amazing how well it went in the end.
Elton is the author of Starting from Scratch, What You Should Know About Food and Cooking. Her daughter's reaction to that sushi dinner, she said it was the best sushi she'd ever had.
And they get so excited. The pride of an accomplishment really affects the way they experience the meal.
Her book is written for maybe fourth or fifth graders, and it provides as much information as it does inspiration. There's a brief history of tomato sauce and a choose-your-own-adventure for cooking onions. She struggles with picky eaters in her house. Her six-year-old, for instance, doesn't like onions. And the key is to get them directly involved with their food at home.
I think all parents are always dealing with kids not wanting to eat things, and a great way to get them to get over their aversions is to get them to understand food and to taste the food and to get into the kitchen and prepare all sorts of things.
And then taste lots of different foods. She quotes taste educator Julia Rogers, who said kids are the perfect taste education students because they don't have any preconceptions about what food tastes like.
And I just loved her idea for getting kids to take a second taste of foods, and foods that they like and foods that they don't like, and to slow down and to take a bite of, say, an apple and to really think about it. Like, what does it taste like? What does it feel like in the mouth?
From the basic enjoyment of food to some more advanced topics, Elton says there's nothing too sophisticated for kids. She even describes the concept of terroir.
I also, as an adult, learned that the grass that a cow eats affects the flavor of the cheese that is made. I mean, and I was an adult and researching a book, and that sort of blew my mind. And my kids know it. It's second nature to them, and they get it.
Kids are smart, so she prefers to provide the information and then let them draw their own conclusions. For instance, the book talks about high fructose corn syrup, what it is, how it's used in food, but she doesn't condemn it as bad for you. When she talks about processed foods, it focuses primarily on how the food industry creates flavors.
That said, when it came to BPA, which is bisphenol A, which is a chemical that's in the lining of cans, that has serious health consequences for children, and so kids should know this. That is information that they need to know to be able to make a decision to say, maybe I don't want to eat canned tomatoes that have BPA in the lining. I'm going to try to look for a BPA-free line of tomatoes, and they're hard to find, and they're really expensive, so maybe that kid will then write a letter and say, hey, tomato company, I want to have BPA-free tomatoes because it's healthier for me.
The idea is to just generate conversations about food because, as she says, what we eat says so much about what we believe, and what we cook tells the world who we are.
The more we talk about it and they understand the ingredients of food and how they work and how they cook, the more likely they are to eat and become more adventurous eaters.
That's a perfect way to end. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me on your program.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Sarah Elton is the author of Starting from Scratch. We'll be making hot chocolate from scratch coming up. How do you like to serve yours? Some marshmallows or maybe with cookies? Chef Daniel Orr goes for an adult option.
But what we're going to do is we're going to celebrate the Midwest with just a wee splash of bourbon.
Before that, temperatures are getting a little warmer day by day. Time to start thinking about tapping maple trees. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations, bloomingfoods.coop. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. Hi there, I'm Annie Corrigan. Every time before we go into the kitchen with Daniel Orr, we ask our followers on Twitter what ingredients they want recipes for. And every time, the number one request is ideas for cooking kale. It is a trendy ingredient still, kale. Wonder if it'll be turnips in a couple years or something. But so Daniel Orr picked up a few different varieties of kale to show us today.
We've got this beautiful dark purple kale that has this nice kind of almost neon-looking center stem, bright purple. What we're going to do is we're just going to pull the heavy stems out of those and put those to the side. Now, you could put those in your compost. You could chop them up and throw them in a soup. You could braise them with some lentils or something. Lots of fiber in those. Then I've got our more traditional green curly kale. And then finally I've got this real long kind of tongue-shaped kale, if you have a real big tongue.
The Gene Simmons of kale?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, leaves have been torn off. Stems are put aside for a soup or a stir-fry later in the week. The oven is preheated. Any idea what we're making yet? Chips. Kale chips.
Okay, and you could make these just plain. Just a little touch of olive oil. That's pretty much all you need. And put a pinch of salt. You got to be careful with the salt because these are going to cook down and it's easy to oversalt greens. All right, so it's better to undersalt than to oversalt. Add a little bit of fresh ground black pepper. And you could do it as simple as that. I'm going to kick it up a little bit with some curry and a little bit of garlic powder. And then we just simply massage the oil and seasonings into the kale. So now we're just going to lay these out on a sheet tray with no additional oil. All right, so now we just put these in a 250-degree oven. It's a nice, slow oven. And you cook them for about 25 to 30 minutes. And the magic of radio.
Ta-da!
They come out like this. For presentation, I like to put them in a rocks glass. So there's nice tall ones kind of stick out of there. Put in a couple of the purple ones for color. Nice and crunchy. A little bit salty, and you get that curry. And a really nice, pleasant aftertaste, I think. And they're so easy to make. Again, one of our quick and simple Earth Eats recipes. Everybody can make these. And a great way to get a little kale into your life.
Daniel says he eats these as a substitute for potato chips. I don't know about that. These are nothing like potato chips. But they're good. They're really good. No junk food comparison necessary. Hope you enjoy them as much as we did. The recipe is at eartheats.org. Today is a beautiful day for tapping maple trees at the Hinkle Garten Farmstead in Bloomington, Indiana.
They were sitting on the table.
Okay.
Exactly. Thanks. Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Michael Bell is the chair of the grounds committee at the farmstead. He's doing a demonstration for a dozen people about how to tap the ground's many mature sugar maple trees.
That's what we need right there.
Bell is trying to be reasonably authentic with how they would have collected sap back in 1886 when the property was first settled. The old-fashioned tap is 7/16 diameter with a hook from which the galvanized bucket and its lid will hang. During freezing temperatures, the tree draws in water from its roots. When the temperatures warm up, it expels sap. The freeze-thaw cycle will produce syrup-worthy sap until the tree grows buds. On days when these trees are really flowing, the 4-gallon buckets will be completely full.
I was just reading something the other day, as the old-timers called it, 100 drips a minute. Sort of like a, you know, like a heartbeat rate, where just kind of at that pace. And what we're looking at when we're tapping a tree is we want to start out with a minimum of 10 inches in diameter. If you go below that size, the tree isn't mature enough to be able to kind of handle that that damage from year to year. And when the tree gets above about 16 inches in diameter, you can tap it up to 2 times. The bigger the tree, the more deeply furrowed the branches are. So it can be a little harder to find a spot that's going to give you access to the, you know, the newest layer of cambium, which is where the sap is flowing.
You want to drill 6 to 10 inches away from any old tap sites because the sap flow won't be as great near the spots where the tree is healing.
So it looks like we've got a good spot right here that's open that would make sure the bucket would hang from. So I'll go ahead and get the drill out. And give this guy a shot right here. So just fit it into the hole and start giving it a whack. And you'll notice a distinct change in tone when it's seated. Right there, it just kind of gets sort of a dead sound. So you know you've got it all the way in. And then from there, just find the hole in the bucket. And get that hook over that, drop it in there. And it's ready to go.
Photos of Michael Bell tapping maple trees at eartheats.org. Daniel Orr back again, ready to make us some fancy hot chocolate.
I remember when I was a kid, the smell of the hot chocolate when he came in from sledding.
He grew up sledding down the rolling hills of southern Indiana.
So this kind of is an adult way to bring back those memories. First of all, we have some really good dark chocolate. You want to use something that's fairly bitter. So we're just going to just really grate it fairly finely. We also have a couple of vanilla beans. And what we're going to do is we're just going to slice those lengthwise. Okay, and when we do that, we're exposing the little seeds inside the vanilla bean. And those are going to really perfume the warm dairy mixture that you have. Over here we have our milk, which I've already scalded. I'm just going to pour that into a nice hot pot. Okay, and then we're going to add our cream. Okay, and then our other flavorings are going to be some cinnamon sticks. I've got 3 pieces of cinnamon stick. I've taken a vegetable peeler and I've peeled half an orange, so we have these nice chunks of orange zest that we'll be able to strain out later. Our sweetener, we're going to use some brown sugar. Okay, I'm going to add the chocolate. Okay, and we're just going to stir that in. We just want all that chocolate to melt and incorporate into the dairy. And once it's done, we can turn off the fire. Hot chocolate is sat for about 5 or 7 minutes. You want to take your whisk and really kind of agitate the liquid, and you're going to make it a little bit frothy. You have your nice warm mugs to ladle your hot chocolate into, and then depending on what you want, you could either put a float of some whipped cream on top, or you could put a marshmallow or even a homemade marshmallow on top of this. But what we're going to do is we're going to celebrate the Midwest with just a wee splash of bourbon. And so it makes it kind of an adult drink, something that you can celebrate with.
Nice. Great for a nightcap this time of year. If you didn't catch all those ingredients, no problem. The recipe is posted at eartheats.org. Our team consists of Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Casey Zakin, and all the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations, bloomingfoods.coop. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for tuning in today, guys. Earth Eats. Until next week, I'm Annie Corrigan.